And I can answer your question about how Irvine is using this research to look at that too. So that maybe that can be one of our breakout topics tomorrow as well. I think we've all looked at that pyramid of Kreidler, the top piece of it with the professional arts organizations as our mechanism for delivery. And now Irvine will start to look at the participatory level and the cultural literacy level and how can we support efforts in those areas as well. So, and I think that's sort of the controversial piece of the research is how do we look beyond what we've historically supported. Tom Caden earlier this morning had a great little diagram that showed research, development, innovation. And we spent some morning talking about the R&D piece, and now we're going to turn to Richard Evans to talk about the innovation piece. Richard Evans is the president of EMC Arts. EMC has worked with a number of large foundations across the U.S., Mellon, Duke, Irvine, most recently, in funding innovation. And why would we fund innovation? How do we define innovation? In an economic climate right now where many arts organizations are focusing on their core product, is it also important to keep them focusing on innovation at the same time and investing in innovation? So I'd like to introduce Richard Evans from EMC Arts to talk about innovation.
Thank you. Thank you, John. Thank you very much. And thank you to Bill and to Alan for wonderfully provocative presentations this morning. We heard many provocative questions, and I was reflecting upon the amount we heard about having a vibrant cultural life and also everything we heard about circling in various aircraft on different flight patterns. I hope then what I have to say this afternoon, I'll have something to say about how we can get towards having a vibrant cultural life and the role that our existing arts and cultural organizations might play in achieving that. And I hope that we'll come down to some practical activities and strategies for grant makers in support of that, as our work is generally concerned with moving research into practice. We'll talk this afternoon about innovation, and I don't think anything could be more exciting or inspiring. But like Edison, that means we have to perspire as well, at least mentally. So I'd like to put my initial accent on failure. I try really hard not to quote my countrymen too much, especially large cigar-smoking ones. But this afternoon, my motto is going to be one of the lesser-known quotations of Winston Churchill, who said that, for him, the definition of success is moving from failure to failure with no loss of enthusiasm. This maxim has clearly been embraced by many corporate CEOs, as we're finding out. But what I think it really points out is how closely connected success and failure really are, maybe even two sides of a single coin, a journey of learning. Success, perhaps, is a measure of how much you can learn from your experiments and your failures. So long as there is constant experimentation, and so long as the effort doesn't wear you down into just repeating old and practiced behaviors, then there is intelligent life and there is the prospect of renewal. The question then becomes, how can we learn to do this experimentation better? To switch allegiances, Samuel Beckett famously wrote late in his life, all of old, nothing else ever, ever tried, ever failed, no matter, try again, fail better. I'm putting all this emphasis on failing, not as a downer during a time of monumental downers, but because I believe that there is a deep problem in the construction of the non-profit arts and cultural sector, in the lack of room made for constructive failure, the insistence on organizational success in every project and every program if support is to be continued. For me, failure is not an option. Sits alongside, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, as among the most unreliable of maxims. If we want an innovative culture, we have to be prepared to allow things not to work, to embrace the attempt, the experiment, and to see repeated constructive failure as the place of maximum learning. In fact, the springboard for real achievement. Failure, in its traditional sense, is also much on our minds right now, with the country being in a mess in so many fronts. I wanted to refer in the title of my talk to Stephen Dedalus's remark in Joyce's Ulysses about errors being portals of discovery. But while I think this is undoubtedly true, it seemed a bit easy in these fraught times. Reflecting on the place of innovation when times are really tough, I was strengthened by conversations with colleagues which reminded me not only of the profound urgency of innovation in such times, but how building the capacity to do things differently with a purpose was really the only road to recovery. It was Thoreau, I think, who said that a man sits as many risks as he runs. The potency of innovation in the arts has never been greater. So I called my talk Portals of Recovery. We describe EMC Arts as a social enterprise for learning and innovation in the arts. As a non-profit agency, we serve as an intermediary for a number of foundations, as John mentioned, providing funds in association with our program interventions. We've realized that our programs essentially cover two types of organizational change. Incremental change, as we help organizations to do better things they already do, and innovative change, through helping organizations to do well things they've never done before. This is a distinction we'll hear a lot about this afternoon. Our approach at EMC Arts to supporting and researching the nonprofit arts sector, I think, complements those that you've heard about from both Alan and from Bill. It's important, hugely important, to understand the shifting terrain for arts organizations that we all have to navigate, to identify the opportunities and challenges that we must, in broad terms, address. But our work is premised on the view that unless arts organizations themselves grow to have the capacities and skills they need to respond to new challenges, we can learn all we like about new technologies, changing demographics, without being able to do anything sustainable about it. The way most arts organizations are set up, or certainly how they develop as they grow, makes them better suited for continuity than for change. And few nonprofits are good at stopping doing things. Yet freeing up resources for well-designed new initiatives, creating what the scholars call slack for innovation, is more important now than ever. It's an irony I'll return to, that our arts organizations typically have at their center hugely creative individuals, yet are structured in ways that inhibit turning that individual creativity into organizational innovation. For the next 30 minutes or so, I'll try to address five questions about innovation. I'll talk about why innovation is so important, how we define it, the lessons that we've learned from our work. I'll talk about the rubric of innovation capacity that we've worked with John at Irvine to develop, and what we're finding from that, and I'll try to end with some implications, particularly for grant makers. As we move through these questions, I'll be using a lot of images, partly because I get the after-lunch spot. Some of them are diagrams to illustrate points, and some of them are photographs that I use to accompany summary statements. These photo images are all from a deck of cards called Visual Explorer, a methodology for non-verbal reasoning developed by the Center for Creative Leadership in Greensboro. Which we worked on with them. We're using them with CCL's permission, for which we're grateful. As metaphorical devices, we found them to be a really useful device for sparking new ways of thinking. Given the importance in innovation of seeing things differently and of making new connections, we found them very useful. And it's different, I hope, for a purpose. So we'll turn to our first question. I'd like to split my answer to this into two parts. First, why innovation is so important, and second, why it's so urgent right now. On the first part, research suggests that innovation is not a natural occurrence in complex self-organizing systems like the arts sector. Rather, such systems gravitate towards stable, repeated patterns of behavior, and it takes a nudge, an intervention of some sort, to change that state. So the answer is a series of eggs. This is an experiment I'd like you to join me in that I stole from Edward de Bono. These are, let's call them entities. They are organizations, they are brain cells, they are individuals, but they are entities with some kind of life that relate to each other in a loosely connected way. will represent the loose connections by a series of lines between these various cells. Now, we could put a line from every cell to every other one. That would be perfectly fine, except it would look even messier than this. So I've drawn in a number of them quite at random. No fixing of this, just drawn them in with only one rule, which is there are at least two lines from every cell to one other one. And we introduced just a simple rule. These organisms, as they connect to each other and relate to each other, have preferences in that regard. As you leave one cell and move to another along one of these connectors, there's a first preference, which I'll indicate by some red dots. And there's a second preference, which I'll indicate with the blue dots. So that's the only rule. Here you have a system of interconnected organisms, which through this simple model of preferences illustrates, I hope, the sense that they have choices around that connection while remaining connected. You have, I think, a copy of this little playful diagram on the tables. And I'd ask you to take your pen and enter this system at any cell you would like, and then observe the rules. That is to say, move your pen from cell to cell. And the only rule is, if you're in a cell, you must go out by the red dot. But if you happen to come into a cell by the red dot, you should leave through the blue dot. I ask you to take 30 seconds and just trace that. Are the rules clear? Yes, just start with any cell and then move your pen from cell to cell. You should leave the cell you start in by the red dot. And you should leave all successive cells by the red dot. But if you happen to come in by a route which is the red dot, you leave by the blue dot. Somewhat like this. And what do you find out? Anything at all? It's a fascinating result of self-organizing systems of this kind that no matter where you enter them, you end up in a repeating pattern, as some of you were just saying. A repeating pattern that does not involve all the cells. And most of you will have arrived at the one I just drew there. There is actually a second one in this if you've come to a different repeating pattern. And I encourage you to reflect that this was done randomly in the sense that the blue and red dots were assigned randomly, the number of connections was random. And this is just a simple model of things that happen in self-organizing systems like the one in which we all work. No matter where you come into the system, you'll eventually end up in a repeating loop, one that doesn't include all the cells. This is true whether it's brain cells or organizations or other entities on the planet. Wherever such bodies are loosely connected, with some interest in relating to each other, you'll end up with a self-organizing system of this sort. The result doesn't need to be stagnation, this repeating loop. It could mean continuous improvement, incremental change that is essential and is to be supported. It can be great in expanding fields, and in fact was the main thrust, I would argue, of 50 years of professionalization in the arts sector. Notice, however, that these loops, however improving, are not inclusive. Parts of the system are inevitably left out, or resources are not utilized, we might say. And note that innovation, doing things differently for a purpose, requires breaking out of the pattern. Repeating loops limit mindsets and mental models and lead to ingrained practices. This won't change without some intervention, some disruption of the system. The fact that the system is so reliable in generating the loop patterns is precisely what militates against being able to break out in that way. So I derive a few lessons from this. That self-organizing systems tend toward patterns of repeated behavior, and that in fact this is their natural state. That new entries to the system, such as you all just were, eventually fall into the same patterns. The patterns may promote incremental change and continuous improvement, which are good for stable and expansionary times, but they are also exclusive and inhibit innovation. For innovation to occur, something needs to change the dynamics of the system. And in case you think that's I'm being too abstract, let me just run that one again for the arts sector. The arts and culture sector tends toward patterns of repeated behavior. This is its natural state. As organizations grow in the arts, they eventually fall into the same traditional behaviors. When the arts have enjoyed stable and expansionist times, these patterns have promoted efficiencies and continuous organizational improvement. But the professional arts sector has become exclusive of others, and organizational innovation has been inhibited. For innovation to occur, something needs to change the dynamics of the system. This is perhaps the important slide. I'm not sure. If there's anyone that's important, it might be this one. And now to the urgency. The world in which we operate has changed radically and quickly in the last 10 years, and we've heard a lot about that today, let alone the last 2 weeks. A number of tipping points have been achieved in terms of, for instance, web use to receive mediated cultural experiences, the interest of young people in curating their own participatory experiences, the change in ticket buying patterns, and the loss of subscriptions. A number of these all occurred at once, and we thought at first maybe it was bad weather. Now we see it's changing the climate. That means that the continual refinement of business as usual, existing patterns of behavior, is becoming ever less effective in ensuring a vital and sustainable future for our arts organizations. Innovation is now no longer a luxury. It's become a bellwether for arts organizations being able to survive and thrive in the future. More and more arts leaders across the country, we find, are realizing that being able to innovate organizationally has become an essential asset if we are to thrive in an environment where few of the old rules still apply. Established strategies are providing fewer net gains in audiences, donors, attention, and so on. And the greater risk may lie in just carrying on as before. To misquote Einstein, doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result would indeed be madness these days. So how are we defining organizational innovation? Was my second question. There's lots written about innovation in the corporate sector, where new products to sustain market share and open up new markets are the lifeblood of commerce. Innovate or die was a well-worn slogan long before it was a YouTube competition. But there's little written about innovation as it applies to our non-profit world, where the interest in following new consumer appetites is tempered by the complexities of a public service mission, an educational role in the community, the interests of donors, and severely limited resources. Innovation may now be essential, but I think we're often confused about what it is. Ask people in the arts, and you'll hear 100 different answers. Is it about theory or practice? Is it the latest gimmick or funding incentive? Is it a serious core competence or an occasional add-on? Is it just novelty for its own sake, or are we talking profound change here? We found no good answer to this in the literature, so we've arrived at our own working definition from our own research and the work of our partner organizations that places innovation in the context of the larger field of organizational change. Innovation seems to have three main parts to it. We propose that organizational innovations are instances of organizational change that provide new pathways to fulfilling the mission, are discontinuous from previous practice, and result from or cause a shift in underlying organizational assumptions. The first part of this definition indicates that innovations are not just novelties unrelated to the organization's mission, nor are they merely variations on existing strategies. Innovative change may be sought when alternative strategies to achieve the mission are not proving of lasting effectiveness, or when challenges to the organization reach a critical level. The second part notes that innovation is not incremental change or a logical extension of business as usual. Innovations take the organization or the program down a new and previously unpredictable path, a path which turns out to be central to the organization's purpose. I'd note in passing that some people want to make innovation and incremental change into enemies. It's one or the other. But that's not what we're seeing in our work around the country. Gradual change and continuous improvement in the work of arts organizations remains of huge value and is essential to organizations continuing to be efficient and competitive. But because sensible improvements over time mean strengthening existing systems and processes, they won't deliver innovation. But they are complementary to it. You can develop your capacity to innovate right alongside a commitment to continuous improvement. You just need to flex different muscles. The third part of this definition, perhaps the most important, suggests that innovation derives from some shift in the fundamental assumptions that the organization has held about its business, who it's for, when and where it happens, and so on. Every organization operates on the basis of some set of shared assumptions about why it exists. These assumptions may be explicit, described in strategic plans and so on, or they may remain hidden of the organization's constituents. Either way, these assumptions act powerfully within the organization. They give rise to the culture of the organization. They inform and limit its capacity for change and explain much of its behavior. In a well-run organization, the alignment between underlying assumptions and day-to-day actions is clear and consistent. Most innovations, I think, exhibit these three qualities in varying degrees, and few possess them all in the extreme. Those that do are generally called disruptive innovations, for obvious reasons. But change runs on a continuum from carrying on as usual at one end to highly disruptive innovation at the other. Not all innovations are at the far end of that continuum, but this definition sets the bar at a level that seems to stimulate some productive dialogue. It follows from the definition that innovation is not restricted only to products and processes that are entirely new to the field or to the world. Rather, it includes strategies that are new to some dimension of an organization's practice, whether it be production, management, governance, community engagement, or financial structure. In fact, stealing new ideas from others is a recommended approach, so long as an organization finds the way to adapt it to its own circumstances. I would note that organizational innovation, as I'm discussing it here, is not individual creativity. The two are often confused, I think, but one is individual, the other is organizational. You certainly need creative individuals if organizations are going to be innovative, but their presence doesn't guarantee it. I sometimes think that the construction of many of our arts organizations actually works against it by separating creation from delivery. Organizational innovation I often describe as a form of controlled release of individual creativity across the organizational domain. Which brings us to some lessons learned. We work on a lot of innovation programs, and I'm going to split this into two parts, what we've learned about designing and managing innovation initiatives, and what we've learned about what I'll call adaptive capacity. I'll concentrate on two programs. One is the Arts Innovation Fund of the James Irvine Foundation that we have the pleasure of working with John and his team on. And the other is the Innovation Lab for the Performing Arts, which we've designed and manage and is currently funded by the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation after a pilot program for orchestras funded by the Mellon Foundation. The Irvine program focuses on building the adaptive capacity of the state's most innovative large cultural institutions. It currently funds 16 leading organizations with budgets over, I think I got it right, 7.5 million. It combines three-year grants, currently up to 900,000, with what John often calls Grants Plus, which is really the work that we're doing as the foundation's strategic partner. We are helping with program development. We are attempting to capture the grantee learning and to open up the awareness of grantees to the ways in which they innovate and make them more self-aware. The program aims to support both the particular innovation projects that the 16 organizations submitted, but also over time to build the adaptive capacity of the grantees. I do think the program is a really bold and innovative step in grant making. One of the things that John often says to the grantees is that you can only fail in this program by failing to learn. And the remarkable thing is that they believe it. Well, most of them believe it, I think. The interest in the foundation and the opportunity I think it's giving these organizations is that freedom to not have an initiative that necessarily can be implemented or that succeeds, but from which they can derive the learning to strengthen their adaptive capacity. The other program is the Innovation Lab. It's a three-part framework. The three phases take single organizations and innovation teams from within them through a disciplined framework to enable them to incubate and prototype innovation initiatives. The three phases happen over about a 9 to 12 month period. And you'll see that in the middle there is what we call the Project Accelerator. It's a week-long residential intensive retreat for all the teams from the organizations in this program. And it's followed by a period of prototyping, testing out the innovative strategy and evaluating it to death before it's finally launched. The various activities of the organizations during those three phases are laid out there, building upon the research which we did in the planning of the program. So a number of lessons we've learned from all this, particularly on specific innovation projects, of which there is a very brief summary in the handout that I think you have, the other handout, which includes a number I won't touch on today. There isn't time for all of them. When an organization is getting started, it needs to be very clear about the purpose of the innovation. What is this innovation supposed to accomplish? And why is it important to the organization? What major challenge that they're facing does it really address? And particularly, is the organization clear why its existing strategies aren't the right ones? Answering these key questions at the start, when no one is quite sure what the response to the challenge will be, provides the sense of alignment and direction that's an essential foundation for innovative work. Organizations should recognize that innovative projects are not like business as usual, only a bit different. They are, in fact, a completely different game. It seems obvious in a way, but over and over again, we see innovative efforts being supported by conventional marketing and development plans, communication strategies, and measures of success, as if they were just different versions of the same old thing. They're not. And trying to graft tried and true approaches from the core business onto the innovation will usually not work. Old mindsets will box you in. Before teams leap into the project, they need to make sure there are some reliable lines to hold them up. They should get permissions from key decision makers in the organization in advance, so the project isn't marginalized over time or thrown overboard when conflicts arise. It's important that someone in a visible leadership role be the sponsor of the project, understand its purpose, and be kept informed of developments. When the project is underway, care should be taken to protect the team and the innovation from business as usual. Innovation teams need island time to develop their best ideas into new strategies, island time being periods to incubate and nurture the fledgling innovation before subjecting it to the attention of the rest of the organization. It was André Gide who said, "One doesn't discover new lands without consenting to lose sight of the shore." This is equally true inside organizations. Allowing the team to operate relatively independent of the culture of the full organization helps legitimize alternative thinking and stops it falling back into the habitual patterns that sustain business as usual. If the team is able to function as an island, they also need at the same time to build a bridge to the mainland, so the team doesn't become isolated within the organization. In the case of successful innovation teams that we've observed, the bridge is frequently an executive leader who can represent the team to the board and to top management, and who can deliver resources and influence in the interests of the innovation. Without such a bridge, an innovation team risks getting out too far ahead of the rest of the organization, having its work seen as threatening. Then it gets marginalized or simply dismissed. The scholar Warren Bennis wrote about all of this in his study of innovation teams in various different fields in the book Organizing Genius, which you may know. And he noted how the really successful ones became great groups, to use his phrase. Not only are these great groups driven to succeed, passionate believers in the journey, and convinced that they can be winning underdogs, they also form the kind of island within the organization that I'm talking about, and maintain a bridge to the mainland. Good communication between these two groups within the organization ensures that the ultimate decisions of the innovation team and the proposals they bring forward aren't simply rejected. Around the midpoint of the innovation process, we've seen the tremendous gains by using an innovation accelerator, like in the lab, an event that pushes the project forward quickly in a short amount of time, or makes it go up in flames, perhaps. We find that an accelerator, like the extended retreats that we've done, can compress several months of work, usually done in a 2-hour meeting every 3 or 4 weeks, into a few days. This can really maintain momentum when it may be in danger of lessening. In the new strategies lab that we did for orchestras that Mellon funded, we shocked the field by requiring the full innovation teams, at least 10 to 12 people from each organization, to participate in a five-day residential retreat. We called them intensives. It was unprecedented for the field, and everybody squealed, but they came, and now participants call them transformative and essential. Time, they say, exists to stop everything happening at once. So is prototyping. As organizations work toward implementation of innovation projects, they should embrace rapid prototyping, repeated tryouts of the innovation in controlled circumstances where the stakes are relatively low. Rapid prototyping enables organizations to see the reality of their ideas early on and to fail safe without exposing an imperfect execution of the idea to a critical public, often at higher cost. When possible, innovators introduce one aspect of the innovation as a small feature, evaluate the prototypes aggressively, and revise for the next iteration. It's critical that innovation teams enroll others to the innovation and work with the resistance. Any group that's been through a transformational and unique experience has moved to a different place from the rest of its organization, just as we all will by being at this conference. Innovations trip up, perhaps more than any other way, by the failure of the team to recognize this and deal with it. They need to spend a lot of time in the implementation phase dealing with skeptical, even hostile colleagues for whom the innovation is basically a problem, someone else's idea that is not only more work, but work we don't know how to do, which is even more challenging. Real champions of innovation recognize these views as valid and systemic, not just curmudgeonly or misinformed individuals. We've found that enrolling stakeholders to innovation projects has also proven for organizations to be an immensely powerful fundraising strategy. If funders see a new approach that is linked strongly to the mission and is not business as usual, we found they frequently respond with new support. And funders or individuals that have never supported the organization start to pitch in. I'll turn to just a few lessons on sustained innovation, what I earlier called adaptive capacity. And here I think my remarks apply equally to funding organizations as they do to producing and presenting ones in the arts. First, I think leaders should learn to be champions of innovation within the organization. For the organization to be consistently innovative, staff, artistic, and board leaders have to sanction the possibility of frequent change and maintain high expectations for innovative ideas. If leaders are appreciative of new ideas from many and unexpected sources and are open to surprises, then the organization will generate much more material on which to build innovations. Consistently innovative organizations are constantly questioning their organizational performance. And we notice that they focus on doing this, especially when things are going well, not just when a crisis is looming, because a trajectory of success provides the best platform for effective change, even while it can blind us to the need. Perhaps most important of all, I'd say develop the capacity to manage the organizational culture so it supports innovation. In this context, culture is the set of rules, values, and norms that guide behavior in an organization. They may well be unwritten, but they act powerfully on everyone, and you quickly find out when you've trodden on one. That's why it's so important to maintain a culture that nurtures innovation. Core assumptions and values should be regularly reviewed, and an overall vision for change reaffirmed. This should be backed up with internal systems that recognize and reward innovation. And we'd recommend using continual questioning and a search for multiple possible solutions to problems as ways to build tolerance for ambiguity around innovation. It's important for grant makers, as it's something we should all expect to find in applications for funding. When organizations are considering innovation, they are less able, quite rightly, to present neatly packaged projects. Instead, the proposals that merit support may be based on half-formed ideas. In applications to the lab, we ask organizations about their readiness, their capacities, and their past experience in attempting innovation, including what they've learned from initiatives that failed. And this slide is for John, because it brings to California that bridge to nowhere. And crucially, organizations that are effective in adapting in the long term build flexible financial resources that are in line with the organization's innovation needs. For a nonprofit, maintaining financial flexibility as the budget grows can be a real challenge. While having more assets may seem to free you up, more often than not, a base of capital funds disables an organization's ability to move quickly and smartly. For instance, if most of the assets are tied up in buildings and endowment, the financial profile and dynamics will be more and more weighted towards conservation, not exploration. Even when the budget is small, developing an expendable fund for innovative ventures can prove invaluable and can serve to focus everyone on responsible risk-taking. Talking about this with Ben Cameron at Duke the other day, we came up with the challenge of getting organizations to devote 15% of their annual budgets to innovation, even 15% of those smaller budgets. And finally, increase the organization's capacity to learn and scan, to scan and to learn from the public square, from external trends and behaviors. Big market research budgets are unlikely to suddenly appear, but there always is Alan, of course. And there are ways to get useful feedback that don't depend upon surveying huge populations. Nowadays, getting continuous feedback from existing audiences remains valuable, but getting outside that group is more important than ever when cultural and leisure choices are so varied. Organizations should continue to do wider surveys and hold focus groups, yes, but they should also try to go beyond that and become a public square, a place that invites communities to converse around as much as about the organization's work. Getting out into unexpected arenas and letting the voices of leaders who've had little or nothing to do with the organization, letting these voices influence planning enormously strengthens the capacity for innovation. It takes us right back to our circles chart earlier on. From these lessons, I'd like to turn to the current work with the Irvine Foundation and talk a little bit about the rubric of innovation capacity. This is a tool that we developed as part of our work with the Irvine Foundation. I mentioned the interest in understanding and building adaptive capacity. This is not something that in organizations in the arts has really ever been measured. So we took on the challenge with a lot of help from colleagues in the field in putting together our own rubric. Everyone has to have a rubric. That would try to identify those particular qualities within the organization that lent themselves to long-term adaptive capacity. What were the muscles, if you like, that organizations flexed when they were, in fact, highly and consistently innovative? I was reminded by the work on this of work I had the pleasure of doing with Marion and her colleagues at Pew years ago in developing the Philadelphia Cultural Leadership Program, where we developed an index of organizational health. And what I realized as I was doing this is that that index, a very dense fabric in its original form, was really about understanding and playing back how organizations do well what they already do, how to become a high-performing organization around business as usual. In a sense, this rubric starts where that leaves off in saying, okay, so what are the muscles that you need to flex if you want to do things differently? We hope to be able to provide feedback to the organizations as well as to the foundation. It's a tool for learning. It's not an evaluative procedure. It's a way for all constituents to learn. It explores 42 different areas of capacity, what we call the innovation muscles, under these four broad headings. It asks the organizations, and we do this by administering in a group meeting with participants from all different constituencies, to look at all these different muscles and locate where they believe the organization is on four levels from low to high. And because it's a standardized instrument, it permits us to do some cross-organizational comparisons. But perhaps most important of all, the facilitated dialogue that happens with all those different stakeholders, many of whom haven't shared the room before, we find, raises awareness of the capacity of the organization. It enables them to make better sense of how they go about their business, particularly innovation. And it promotes the idea that they might focus on a small number of innovation capacities to develop in the future. This is a page from it. which I don't expect you to be able to read at that size. But I'll just pick out the second line as an example. Here you see the four different levels across the page and note spaces at the bottom. And in the middle is the concept of where the organization sources its imaginative, its innovative ideas. Is it an organization in which innovative ideas are only considered legitimate if they're generated by board and staff leaders? Are innovative ideas from some other sources occasionally tolerated and discussed? Are innovative ideas welcomed from a variety of sources and discussed? Or do innovative ideas from all sources, are they given space for consideration, selective development and implementation? Different levels of that muscle, and the organization's each individual checks off the box they want to put the organization in. We collect all those, we produce averages, and then we compare the organizations, which enables us to come up with something like this, which is a wonderful thicket, a picker stick, which will give Marion a chuckle, because I used to produce things like this with the Index of Organizational Health we did in Philadelphia. Our job is to make sense of these, to look through the thicket and see what stands out. And I just want to give you a couple of early responses. We've done this so far with 11 organizations of the 16 in the AIF program, and we're very interested in doing it with a much wider base. That's only 100 people or so in those 11 organizations. We'll be repeating it with those organizations over the next few years, but we're looking to have a much wider base as well. Some things start to emerge as to what the most advanced capacities are among AIF grantees, and I draw your attention basically to the sort of the green here, not the detail. What do we find are the capacities in the index which are turning up at the highest levels most consistently across these highly innovative organizations? Well, there may not be surprises here, but it's interesting to have the empirical evidence. Positive leadership in relation to innovation and a culture that is inclusive. We find this is the highest single indicator, that the vision for change among the leadership is one that includes a central role for innovation. And it's backed up by the board expecting innovative thinking throughout the organization, and that those innovative ideas from all sources are given space for consideration. The second quality is the ability of the organization to do consistent external scanning and communication, that they regularly conduct external scans and they communicate new initiatives in a way that relates to stakeholders' interests, a critical part of their communication strategy. The third is that when it comes to implementing innovation, implementation is thought through and supported, and the expertise needed to do that effectively is acquired. Too many organizations that are not highly innovative believe that you can take the same job descriptions, the same job tasks, and use them all the way through your innovation activities, when in fact they have to be retooled, or sometimes new expertise is needed, even if it's only for a period of time. Highly innovative organizations seem to understand this, and their implementation becomes that much more reliably successful. And finally, they use the measures of success they develop for innovation in order to learn. It's a very clear aspect of the organizations in the Irvine program that measures are not punitive, and perhaps most important of all, they're not the same measures as are used for business as usual. One of the things that most trips up innovation in any sector, we've learned from the research, is to apply the metrics of success that you used for business as usual to the innovation that you're undertaking. These organizations develop measures of success that are specific to that innovation, and they use them to learn. On the other hand, and let me just ask you before I go on to the other hand, what kind of an organization this is. Just imagine for a moment an organization that has very advanced capacities in these four areas. It's an organization that is hugely inclusive within the organization, that is constantly demanding new ideas and listening for them and making them tell. But it's also very porous to the outside world, with this continual external scanning and inviting in of feedback and of stakeholders. It's an organization that recognizes that it is somewhat provisional in its structure, in the sense that it brings on new expertise as needed and organizes itself effectively for implementation. And it seeks to learn at all times from that. I think we can contrast this with what have come out so far as the five lowest or least advanced innovation capacities, and they may not surprise you. Organizations find it very hard to make provision for risk capital in their financial profile. If they're very lacking in advancement in relation to innovation. They have weak procedures to make resources available. They have few decision-making processes for conflict, and they use data very poorly when conflicts come up around innovation projects. They give very little latitude to different points of view within the organization. And their focus of communications externally is only on established programs. Once again, I want to ask you what kind of an organization that is, or to think about that, because it's very clear to us from this work that this is not necessarily a weak organization at all. It's important to remember that the left-hand end of the rubric isn't about being a poor organization. It's about being an organization that may be extremely good at business as usual, but find it very difficult to adapt. And if you look at these, most of these qualities here, what they're actually describing in many ways is a command and control structure in which there is a strong party line, in which there is potentially at least great aptitude to doing what we've always done, but there's very, they find it very difficult to move away from that norm and do things differently. So a very different kind of organization than that on the previous slide. These are some of the early findings from the rubric for innovation capacity. We'll be working more on it. We're revising it and going around again in the next 6 months with those organizations. I wanted to end just with some reflections on what this might mean for grant makers in particular. And I have four or five of these just very briefly. The first reflects something that Bill Ivey brought up this morning that I think is really fundamental, that we are entering a new era. I think there was a period of time, the time that John Kreidler describes so well in his writings, when the major capacity we looked for in arts organizations is what I've called growth capacity. And I think we're moving to an era of a more mature arts ecology where what we're looking for is adaptive capacity. It may seem a subtle change, but it's, I think, huge in its implications. Moving from, not necessarily that growth won't happen, of course, smaller organizations will continue to see opportunities and get larger, but the overall focus is much more on how effectively organizations can now adapt rather than simply how can they grow. And that shift, I think, calls upon grant makers themselves to be innovative in their approach because we haven't lived in this place before. I think in line with that, we're seeing that traditional strategic planning is giving way to incubating innovation. Strategic planning entered the arts field in earnest, I think, in about the 1970s. The burgeoning of the NEA, the state arts councils, and foundation support led to a desire by funders in particular for their support to be backed by evidence of grantees' ability to chart a logical and responsible linear course for the future that grant funds would in part support. I think that era is coming to a close. Traditional strategic planning was always guessing at the future, but the guesses informed by good historical analysis were typically close enough to how things turned out for them to be a useful guide to action. Those were what mathematicians would call classical conditions. Now we live in an operating environment for the arts that no longer lends itself to those kinds of rational presumption. Chaotic conditions where complex, non-predictable change is the norm. So in those circumstances, strategic planning actually becomes highly fallible and may even serve as a distraction from developing the responsiveness and nimbleness that we now truly need. I prefer now to think of planning as a constant improvisation around a sense of direction, a phrase I got from a cookery book. From this perspective, building capacity for change rather than linear planning becomes the priority for organizational advancement and sustainability. And the incubation of innovation becomes the framework within which to consider multiple futures and to design, organize, and test effective strategies to meet today's challenges. I expect to see grantmakers giving the space for incubating innovation that in the past they've afforded to strategic planning. I also use the word systematized here quite deliberately and with deliberate reference to a fairly recent Kellogg Foundation report on innovation in the social sector that many of you may have read called Intentional Innovation. It actually arrives at a remarkable number of conclusions similar to the ones I've come to and our work has suggested to us quite separately from our own work. And the authors emphasize that far from being a mysterious event akin to lightning striking, innovation can be approached systematically using frameworks like that of the Innovation Lab that we run. It's a fascinating report that covers a huge amount of ground and has lots of capsule descriptions of philanthropic interventions in support of innovation. I'd recommend it to everyone on the Kellogg website now. I think another thing that funders can do is validate the seeds of emerging innovation. We found that it's very often the case that certain individuals in a cultural organization are quiet champions of innovation, but their voices can be scattered and lack resonance across the organization. By supporting these seeds and causing them to come together, funders can create critical mass for innovation. The technical term for this is funding positive deviance, which is something that all good liberal funders want to give support to. Positive deviance describes the actions of those whose attitudes and behaviors tend to depart from the organizational norm, but in ways that show signs of generative and lateral insight. Reinforcing these voices and giving them visibility and authority inside the organization can create a tipping point, leveraging the release of potential, sometimes with extraordinary speed. I think also that funders can use support for innovation as a way to take a look at new organizations. Many of the things we heard about earlier today, about breaking out of traditional structures and being more inclusive in our thinking about what constitutes the arts economy, suggests that funders may want to engage with organizations they don't previously have relationships with. Support for innovation projects can be a way to do that, and also a way to build a new kind of relationship with existing grantees. And finally, I began by referring to our current difficult environment for the arts and by linking innovation to the notion of constructive failure. I want to end by asserting that innovation is the way to address this environment and avoid the certain failure that comes from organizations cutting and reducing without rethinking more thoroughly how it is they do business. Some people will say, how can we be innovative at a time of financial retrenchment? And how can grantmakers continue to urge and support innovation when organizations are beginning to cut budgets, lose donors, and see endowments yield less? My point is that innovation isn't always or necessarily about doing more. And we should all seek to be as innovative in how we think about downsizing as we are in calmer times regarding potential growth. Downsizing, while it may be painful in the short term, can be releasing of new energies as well as greater clarity about purpose. Innovative thinking coupled with prudent choice making is indeed really the only formula for moving through times of real uncertainty. But because downsizing or restructuring are traditionally not seen as opportunities for innovation, only the negative aspects of these actions are identified and predicted. But if we see situations like these as opportunities for innovation, it encourages us to put more on the table than just the areas of work most vulnerable to budget cuts and helps us to move away from triage, to look again at how we might reconfigure our work for different times in order to move forward more effectively. Seeing responses to market cycles and recession as primarily opportunities for innovation would allow us to identify, predict and support outcomes that confirm the value of each organization's continuance and legacy. Such things as more open and interdependent cultures, lessened avoidance of uncertainty, faster decision-making, and less distorted, more creative communications, a more vigorous engagement with both the art form and the community. It may even be one of the ways that organizations can begin to develop those stronger merit goods that Bill referred to this morning. No question that more highly adaptive arts organizations would emerge, better equipped to seize the upside opportunities that always emerge after the storm. Or, as Wendell Berries put it in his uplifting poem, The Real Work, it may be that when we no longer know what to do, we've come to our real work, and that when we no longer know which way to go, we've begun our real journey. The mind that is not baffled is not employed. The impeded stream is the one that sings. Thank you. there.
Thank you, Richard, for sharing your research with us. We want to open for Q&A for about 30 minutes. Emily?
I have a question.
What would be your name and your
organization? Now I'm going to get my
Yeah, right. We hear you.
Anyway, my question is whether or not there is any thought given to, rather than funding positive deviance within established organizations, looking at the presence of disruptive technologies in these communities. We've been hearing a lot about informal arts or community-based arts, which I would argue could become the disruptive technology or even are the disruptive technologies to the established C3 sector.
Yes, I think it's the move from only applying this approach to innovation to existing 501c3s or organizations of any legal type is expanding to address the question of the kinds of new connections and networks that are needed to deliver some of the things you describe that don't necessarily reside within the immediate purview of those existing organizations. It's just a much harder strategy to actually operationalize, if you will. We've begun to hear about interest in having structures like the lab structure for incubating innovation applied not to single organizations, not even to organizations, but to groups in communities that want to come together around key potential for innovation. I don't know of any programs that really do that in the context of innovation yet, but it's a logical development of the approach that I think that's being taken. Having said that, part of the challenge that I think existing organizations face and need to equip themselves to deal with is how not to be the organizations they were and how to engage with individuals, with emerging initiatives that don't even have any corporate form in such a way that they can break out of the expected patterns of behavior. So I think both are possible. In fact, one of the things that's most intriguing about... I love it. It's the call to order. I think we all have to pray, right? Point one direction, anyway. One of the things that's intriguing is, and I'm skeptical about is the interest that's developing in giving very large funds to organizations that say we want to do fundamental restructuring. Because one of the things we've learned, and it may be limited experience, but it's pretty consistent so far, is that some of the most radical innovations we're dealing with or have come across have emerged from groups of individuals within organizations that had a good idea, moved it forward to a point that was beyond idea generation, but it wasn't particularly organization-wide. It was about a particular thing they could do really differently. But as they did that and as they explored that project, there was this kind of aha moment when it was seen in a completely new light and took on a profundity and a set of implications for the whole business of that organization that couldn't have been conceived in advance. And I'm not yet convinced that organizations that can articulate that kind of fundamental restructuring in advance of doing anything are necessarily going to be ones that merit significant funding. I think we have to find a way to support organizations to keep on in that place of ambiguity, to find the really creative solutions that can't always be predicted in advance. And I think that, too, is another way to approach this. I didn't... Yes. If there's ever a hiatus, we can always rely on. I tell you what, we can hear you. Yeah.
I was also having a difficult time imagining how this knowledge could be applied to smaller organizations unless it was tied to some entrepreneurial expansion that would help them stabilize themselves. And I would encourage you to go there next. It's really, really complicated. I think that you'll learn a lot of the field by taking this knowledge and applying it to a small organization that really doesn't have the capacity
right.
to
Right. To that, and I'll come back to your question about very small organizations, which I think is really interesting. I don't want to allow what I said at the end to be to suggest that innovation is either about expansion or about downsizing. It's frequently about neither. It can be about not doing some things you already do in order to do something really differently. And in fact, given the lack of resources that the system creates within arts organizations, we're all like people who've survived a boat being turned upside down. We're in the water, and there's a little pocket of air, and we've all got our noses up trying to keep above water. It's very hard to do more, even in good times. What we want to do is devote a proportion of our energies to doing things differently on a consistent basis. So I don't think it's only about expansion. But as for downsizing, John can answer as well as I, probably better on that one. I don't think in the Irvine program we've seen an organization yet, but I mean the yet is the important thing, that has, through this program, brought forward or been involved in a downsizing operation. We've seen some quite significant rethinking of aspects of the work, which might result in smaller or different activities, which is the beginnings of rethinking the kind of business we are. I think it remains to be seen over the next few years, John, whether they have to tackle that larger question as well.
Right. They're thinking about their marketing and their development departments as separate entities, and now they have merged them into one customer relation department. So that was somewhat of a restructure, somewhat of a, I don't want to call it downsizing, but a shift in the way the organization did business. So you have one customer that interacts with one staff person, not a ticket sales person, and a development person, and maybe et cetera.
Yeah. And to come back to the question about small organizations, you're absolutely right that many of the lessons we've learned and many of the organizations we're dealing with are organizations that have to have sufficient capacity to go through some quite rigorous processes while they continue to manage business as usual. We set the bar for the innovation lab at a minimum of 5 full-time equivalents in the organization, which is a budget usually of around $500,000 or so. So that's absolutely the case, and it's that particular program is appropriate for organizations that size and above, I believe. We've seen ones that can manage it. The ones who find it hardest in some ways are the very large ones. But one of the things that underlies all this that I find intriguing, and I mentioned it early on, is the way that our organizations, I think, have developed in the arts in such a way as to almost insulate the creative core of the institutions from the delivery mechanisms. And I referred to the idea of a controlled release of that creativity to inform organizational innovation. And I think I even suggested that the lack of that controlled release is one reason why arts organizations have a lot of trouble with organizational innovation. So I think that actually in some ways for small organizations, particularly those led by artists, they are much closer to having the material they need at the core of the organization, freer to act, than are many organizations that have developed a traditional corporate structure. So although I wouldn't argue that some of the programs I've been describing are simply appropriate, I see enormous potential in what is already the highly creative work of single choreographers or of theatrical leaders and playwrights and in small unincorporated organizations to actually not grow up to be the kinds of organizations we've seen in the past, not to separate the creative and the delivery functions, but to think about how to always use their creativity across the whole set of capacities needed to be effective in promoting and producing their work. It's an irony to me that we have not made fully use of that, and I think there's a potential.
Lawrence Thu with the San Jose Office of Cultural Affairs. I come from a region where we, at least in the for-profit sector, we pride ourselves on the slogan of having a culture of innovation. But when we look at the cultural sector within our region, I don't think one would apply that characterization easily. And I'm wondering, most of your presentation this afternoon focused on innovation within an organization, within a single organism, if you will. And I wonder if you have any thoughts about developing a culture of innovation in the cultural sector.
A culture of innovation that's larger than and different from that within a single organization. It's an intriguing question, and in part I think it raises the question that almost everyone earlier today raised about how we disseminate and communicate. There's that's one part of it, because there's no question that innovation in part will continue to happen where there are the frameworks, organizational frameworks and capacities for that to happen. But how do we share that? How do we create more impetus towards shared innovation across individual communities or whole fields of endeavor? And I've been meeting with all the service organization heads in the performing arts and museums recently to ask that question and to see what they're seeing that they think could be ways to expand. And they've had hardly anything to say on that subject. I mean, what they've had to say is that there's very little, that our traditional conferences do not offer the right kind of vehicle. And one of the things that emerged from those conversations, for instance, and this might apply locally or regionally as well as nationally, is that when it comes to new enterprises and new activities, new projects, we tend to take a sort of case study approach. We tend to talk about the results, the behavior, not those three things I put up on the definitional slide that have to do with the underpinnings. So what you tend to get is people saying, well, that was really interesting for them, but it doesn't apply to us. Our situation is different. And that's a fair enough reaction. And particularly with innovation, which has to stem from this shift in underlying assumptions within the organization and has to relate to the mission of that organization. It's very hard, if you're dealing only with the behavior and the results, to have that translate to another organization. So I think one of the first things is that we have to find a new kind of discourse, a new kind of way of sharing what innovations are that goes down beneath the surface and really undertakes the dialogue at the level of assumptions and the relationship of the organization to its mission and to its stakeholders. Having said that, as a sort of communication strategy, I think your point also comes back to this fascinating prospect of applying some of the frameworks for incubating innovation that have derived from research and that I talked about today to whole communities, to organizations working together, and to leaders of organizations working in cross-organizational settings. One of the things we've found as a common theme, even though we haven't yet adopted that strategy in the lab, is that the kinds of projects coming forward almost always involve partners in the community. And the innovation teams that are created have not been the usual suspects with inside the organization, even symphony orchestras, where you'd expect that what they would bring in is the senior management team and a couple of board members. I think Bill made reference to the work in Memphis that was done by the symphony working with Stax Academy and with FedEx, which was one of the lab projects. And they were able to bring in external partners in a very ambiguous and uncertain way to immense power in creating a program led by musicians for FedEx managers, worldwide, we hope, ultimately. So this porosity to the community, this breaking down of organizational boundaries, is beginning to happen, even if the point of entry is a single organization. So I think that's another pointer to how we begin to see that the larger culture of innovation can begin to be created at the community level. But I would love to try that out with whole groups of organizations. There hasn't been an initiative of that sort yet.
Bill Ivey from Vanderbilt. I was wondering, Richard, if you would comment on the challenge of nonprofit cultural organizations as vehicles for innovation, given the fact that they have mission statements, charters, stated purposes, and would seem to be less than ideal incubators of innovation, given those limitations. So I really have two questions. One is kind of an expression of concern. That is, if foundations are suddenly coming to their nonprofit partners and saying, we want you to innovate, I think that's an invitation for organizations to be pulled off mission in pursuit of appearing innovative. And I remember back in my years with the Country Music Foundation when we became highly innovative. It was usually in the pursuit of money, and it was usually pulling us off mission to some extent. But the question is, in your innovative, in your workshop or your innovation process, do you have a formal way of maintaining mission or stated purpose for the organization as that organization works on innovative programming? In other words, is there a formal way of continually coming back to saying, all right, how does this measure up against mission?
Yeah, thank you, Bill. I think that what we've been doing is, you know, really applying that definitional construct pretty continuously in the work, so that the questions about, is this a new pathway to the mission or a byline? Is it a distraction? Is one of the key questions. That was the first part of that definition. And one of the reasons we came up with that was precisely because of the danger that, Bill, you identify. We did a presentation in Denver at the National Performing Arts Convention called New Frills or Deep Change. I mean, is innovation just new frills? Is it something that can distract you from getting on with the serious work you have to do because the money's moving in that direction, which I understand is a danger. So it's really important all the time to be testing the emerging strategy against your capacity to fulfill the mission and whether or not it goes in that direction. Having said that, there are the disruptive end of that equation. The first part of that definition is one in which the innovation starts to mean that you have to question your mission itself, and you might even change the mission. And to me, that's a perfectly legitimate, deep and difficult conversation in which an organization may indeed choose to do that. We don't think that way. I mean, for 50 years, we haven't really thought that way. We've been creating, as Bill said earlier, a supply-side economy in which almost the right of everyone to set up their own organization and then get funds and go on receiving them has been taken for granted. We're beyond that now. And so missions that change over time because of either something is worn out and done or because conditions change and we need to have a different approach, I think are now very legitimate questions to have on the table. It's always a good question to make sure we're not confusing, if I may, innovation with craftiness, guile, which is always acceptable but has to be kept within limits, I think. So we keep going back to that. And we try to facilitate these processes in a way that build ownership in that in the organization, because even in the work we do, it's no good if we're the ones bashing on about that. Ultimately, the organizations have to themselves be looking at that, which is part of what the innovation rubric is trying to create self-awareness for in the Irvine program. So it's important to keep one's eye on that, yeah, and not be distracted.
Hi, Richard. Lisa
hey,
Kremen
Lisa.
With the Metropolitan
Hello.
Atlanta Arts Fund. In your work in innovation, are you seeing any patterns with stage of life cycle in organizations and their ability to embrace and take on innovation mm-hmm. practices and mm-hmm. behaviors?
Ooh. That's a good question. Thank you. I made one reference earlier to that in the sense that I do think, within my limited experience, that as arts organizations get larger, their budgets get larger, there is a very strong impulse and almost requirement. They become either more and more mainstream in their artistic offerings or more and more avant-garde, if I can put it that way. The first way is the way to individual donors and ticket sales. The second is the way to foundation support. I'm exaggerating for effect, but there's a tendency for larger organizations to be more mainstream and more stuck in the programs that they have been offering. It's harder for them to be nimble because they set up support systems to keep themselves going, to achieve continuity. Whereas, as we all know, smaller organizations are more opportunistic, more capable of taking on new kinds of business because they may not even have arrived at the stage where they're clear what their core business is. So the problems or challenges in innovating, I think, are equal in both cases, but they're very different. With large institutions, it's a matter of them being often caught in those repeating loops that we looked at and having to have quite considerable interventions to get the mindsets to come out of that, to give a space for innovation. With the smaller organizations, those are the younger in their lives as well, that's much less the case. And in some ways, I think that is the most leveraged place. But on the other hand, there's often a relatively low amount of capacity to implement the changes which are then called for. So there's no one answer or a sort of perfect stage of the life cycle or size of organization which I would pick out and say offer the ideal conditions. We found them in organizations of all sizes. We had orchestras in the orchestra program from the Nashville Chamber Orchestra to the Philadelphia Orchestra, and they both in their own ways found the way to do this. What we do know is from other reports is that those middle-sized organizations are always incredibly vulnerable. And I think a lot of emphasis might be placed on, particularly in the coming couple of years, on those organizations being helped to be genuinely innovative as they rethink who they are. I think that'll be called for.
Thank you, Richard.
Nope.
That's about our time for this session. Richard will be joining. Richard will be joining Ben Cameron from Duke, Lorenzo Labrija from Knight Foundation, and myself on Monday afternoon to talk about funding innovation as part of the main conference. We're having a dialogue, so we invite you to join us there if you'd like to continue this conversation. We're going to take a 10-minute break.